From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Leah Fleming. This week marks 3 months since the deadly mass school shootings in Parkland, Florida. Since then, we've heard public outrage transform into ever more urgent calls for reforms of the nation's gun laws. One point on which both sides of the gun debate can agree is not allowing mentally ill people access to guns. People like the man who threatened a school shooting in Decatur in 2013. Just ahead, we're going to bring you more about that case. But first, we want to hear from you. Should people who have a mental illness be barred from owning a gun? We love hearing from you. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Colleges and universities across Georgia have wrapped up the semester, but one Morehouse College man has more work to do. What started out as an extra credit biology assignment for student Julian Turner has become a world of opportunity. Last year, the rising junior went viral with a music video of a song he wrote, inspired by Lil Uzi Vert's hit single, XO Tour Life.
I don't really care if you cry. I don't really shouldn't have a lie. Should've saw the way she looked me in my eyes.
Turner's remix is called XY Cell Life. It breaks down differences between mitosis and meiosis.
The DNA starts to unwind. The RNA reads the other side. Meiosis is the key to making life. Mitosis.
This YouTube video has been viewed more than a million times and praised by artists like Common and Chance the Rapper. Well, now Julian and his brother Justin have been commissioned to create an educational music video for Sesame Street to air in the fall. Julian Turner joins me now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So this is an experience that every college student has, where you get an assignment and then you have to make it work.
Yeah, yeah.
So take us through the process. What happened with you?
So basically, I was in my bedroom after a football game, and I forgot about the project. And when I was listening to the song, All My Cells Are Dead just kept playing in my head, and I was like, that's a part of an extra credit assignment I could be doing right now. And so, you know, I checked my notes to see if it was accurate, and then I started just putting together lyrics. And, you know, I do that with my friends all the time, and I didn't think it was going to be much of a big deal. I just had my friend come over, record the video. I put it together in my room, and then I just posted it. And from then, it just took off. It was just, it's crazy.
Yeah, we see you in your dorm room.
Yeah.
And then there's a scene of you, I think, out on campus. And
yeah, I was in the library.
In the library.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, you and your friends, you probably enjoy rap music, maybe a little trap music.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that music, not all of it, but a lot of it does have some themes in it that some find objectionable, derogatory toward women, some of those themes,
mm-hmm.
and maybe this talk about drug life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, do you think that maybe your rap video became such an internet sensation because there's an appetite out there for smarter rap?
Yeah, I think I think it blew up because there's a hole in rap, because there's a lack of educational content or a lack of content that could relate to broader audiences in a sense, you know. So, you know, I think a lot of my feedback has been from the audiences of in the science community, audiences of parents in children, and you see in rapping on the radio, a lot of that, you know, a lot of the music doesn't appeal to that type of audience. So I think that's what made up my audience and what kind of helped it blow up. And then also it helped, you know, that it was towards the end of the semester, and, you know, this topic that's covered in elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, and colleges. So I think that it was really universal in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sesame Street, the producers there, they certainly had an appetite for what you did because they saw it and they reached out to you. Can you tell us a little bit about what your project will be?
Yeah, so it's a live action short on the number 6. So whatever episode they decide to include it in, they'll be trying to teach the number 6, and they'll play our video along with music, whatever we creatively decide to do to help illustrate the number six.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
So back in the 1970s, long before you were born, there was this character, and his name was Roosevelt Franklin. And he was a purple brother. He had spiky, natural hair. And he was probably the street's original rapper, Sesame Street's original rapper. And I want to play a little bit of him. He's teaching his classmates how to rhyme.
Okay.
Searched in the mountains, he searched in the hills, he searched in the oven and the windowsill. He looked in the country, he looked in the town, where he finally found Sam Sam Brown.
I can rhyme anything, baby.
Sam Sam Brown was a rhyming.
All right,
man.
So that is Roosevelt Franklin. He always kind of talked to a beat.
Yeah.
And since 1969, Sesame Street has done this. They have used popular culture to really help kids learn, and they've used these relatable characters. So I'm wondering, is that what you and your brother are planning for your project?
Yeah, in a sense, we also want to bridge the gap between a lot of different styles as well. So I think we're going to try to do a mix of hip-hop and try to bring in some other cultures as well. Not limit ourselves in terms of what we're doing, but all of our projects we've attempted to educate through entertaining, whether it was rhyming or with the beat. So I think that's what we're going to try to continue to do.
That's Morehouse College student Julian Turner. His educational music video should be released this fall on Sesame Street, which we now visit with Fran Brill of Savannah. She's the first female puppeteer that Jim Henson hired for the program. You may recognize this lovable character.
My name is Zoe, and I'm proud, I'm proud, I'm proud. And what I'm proud about, I'm gonna tell you right out loud. I can spell my name.
Zoe was just one of the many characters that Fran Brill played on Sesame Street. GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley talked with her about her long career on one of the most recognizable streets in America.
I keep imagining that first day walking onto the set, and it's all guys. Well, at least underneath the puppets.
Yeah, but you know what? I just didn't think about it. It really didn't hit me. I was lucky enough that they were very kind to me because they all were very good puppeteers, the core group, and I had never played with a puppet in my life before I got hired. This would never happen today. But I had all the other tools that Jim was looking for in a female puppeteer, and then I learned how to manipulate very quickly, you know, with everybody's help. But they were just super to me, and it was just the greatest thing in the world. I mean, I guess to be the only female amongst this incredible group of hysterically funny, wonderful men.
Well, many people know you for Zoe, but let's hear from another character that you voice, which is Cammy, and that was the first HIV-positive Muppet.
The other children at school don't want to play with me because I'm HIV-positive. They say they don't want to touch me because they think I will make them sick.
Oh, but Cammy, we all know you can't get HIV just by touching someone or by being friends with them.
What do you make of Sesame Street's role in these more difficult conversations?
Well, this clip you played was from Takalani Sesame, which is the African version of Sesame Street. You know, there's like 175 productions of Sesame Street all over the world, and they all cater to a specific social or environmental or educational problem in that world.
Why don't we play another clip? Because it's basically the same topic, which is about the responsibility of handling difficult subjects. And this clip relates to that. And it's from 2009. Sesame Street did a primetime special because of the Great Recession. It was called Families Stand Together, Feeling Secure in Tough Times. And in this particular clip, we're actually hearing you playing the role of Elmo's mom.
Ah.
Why isn't Mommy at work today?
Well, darling, there's something your daddy and I want to talk to you about.
Come on, sit over here, son.
Okay.
Sit down.
Okay,
here.
Daddy.
Right. Now, you see, yesterday I lost my job, and I'm not going to be working, at least for a little while.
Is it because Elmo has too many toys?
Oh, no, baby. None of this is your fault.
It's nobody's fault. This is just something that happens in families sometimes.
So how carefully do you have to tread in with subjects like this when it may be for kids the first time someone's talking directly to them about a subject like AIDS or a family member?
Yeah, that's a great question. All I can tell you is that there is a tremendous amount of research that goes into every script. You get a lot of very smart people together and talented writers, and the script is read over and over and over again before we performers, you know, get to shoot it. We also, Elmo's mom and Elmo's dad and Elmo did another show where they were talking about the military and that, you know, how do children deal with a parent who's, you know, doing service in a country far, far away. We never said what country it was, but Elmo's mom and Elmo were Skyping Elmo's dad.
Oh, well, Elmo sure has, Daddy.
Oh, good. Well, so have I. And I think about you every time I do. But you know what? Pretty soon, we'll be able to say goodnight to the moon together again. I'm coming home real soon.
Really?
Go! Where are you going, son?
Well, Elmo wants to get everything ready when Daddy gets home. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
We'll help. We'll help.
You know, it's wonderful. I think it's what makes me the proudest of being a part of this show is that I feel like, well, I did something with my life. It's great that people are affected by this and children grow up feeling safer, perhaps, because subjects that are difficult to talk about are dealt with. Adoption, blended families. I mean, they're dealing with all sorts of heavy-duty stuff.
Do children, I mean, I have to expect that children often assume you're basically Zoe, right? When they hear you talking?
No, I mean, they don't know anything. I think it's so funny when an adult woman, you know, pulls over her three-year-old child and she says, "Oh, honey, look, this is the lady that does Zoe." And they look at me, and I'm not 3 years old anymore. I haven't been three for a long time. But they look at me, and it's like, what? You know, and then she says, oh, do the voice. So when I do the voice, and I talk like that, they go, oh, my gosh, it's Zoe! You know, so I'm sorry, the mics probably just
that
blew
awesome.
Out over there.
No, that's awesome.
I could just pick up a puppet and do whatever crazy voice or person came to mind. I have this Mrs. Crustworthy, who I really, really like to do, who sort of sounds like she's drunk, but actually it's because her dentures are slipping. So I'll do Mrs. Crustworthy around the house sometimes. I mean, it's sad. It's sad. I know it's sad.
It is not. It is objectively not.
No, this has been a joy. That my life has been fabulous, and just to have been part of this world, I consider I'm one lucky chick.
That's Fran Brill of Savannah, the first female puppeteer Jim Henson hired for Sesame Street. She spoke with my colleague, Celeste Headley. It's On Second Thought. I'm Leah Fleming. The school shooting controversy was reignited in February when 17 people were killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. In some cases, people behind these crimes are dealing with some form of mental illness, including the man who attempted a school shooting in Decatur back in 2013. GPB intern Destiny Robinson reports on Michael Brandon Hill and his history of mental illness.
This August makes 5 years since the incident at Ronald E. McNair Discovery Learning Academy in DeKalb. The shooter, Michael Brandon Hill, suffered from several mental disorders throughout his life. His brother, Timothy Hill, was there through it all.
We were both raised the same way, not treated differently, and we had a pretty close bond growing up until our teenage years.
As a teenager, Michael's first crime was committed back in 2009 when he tried to set his house on fire with 8 people inside, including his brother. Timothy says the justice system brushed aside the incident, never giving Michael the long-term care he needed.
They didn't really try. He had been in and out of the mental institution at least a dozen or more times. They would just do nothing but try to medicate him, thinking that would help. That doesn't help with anybody.
4 years later, Michael walked into an elementary school in DeKalb carrying an AK-47 and 500 rounds of ammunition. There, he encountered Antoinette Tuff, an employee at the school who called 911.
Yes, ma'am. I'm on 2nd Avenue in the school, and the gentleman said, tell them to hold down. The police officers are coming, and he said he's going to start shooting, so tell them to back off.
Tuff was able to talk him down before anyone was injured by telling him how she tried to commit suicide just a few days prior. She says the 21-year-old was a child in crisis.
He was just like the child that's next door. He was just like our children that are in our homes that are crying out for help. So for me, what I seen was a young man saying, can someone see me? Can someone hear me?
Michael was sentenced to 20 years in prison. His defense lawyer, Annie Dietz, works in a specialized mental health division for DeKalb County. She says Michael's history tells the story of a man who had multiple suicide attempts, hospitalizations, and a low IQ.
From the outset of his life, he was at a distinct disadvantage from say, you or I. Our system does a decent job of protecting juveniles. But when he aged out of that system, he found himself homeless, without supports, and just kind of cast aside by society.
Instead of prison, Dietz believes her client should have been sent to a mental health facility where he could receive specialized treatment. But she says more financial backing is necessary.
We deinstitutionalize this population of people. Without the funding to support these community mental health centers, people are not set up to succeed. They don't have the supports necessary.
The mental health debate continues to receive attention in the wake of recent school shootings. Dr. Elaine Walker is a researcher at Emory University. She says a decline in social engagement and the development of negative emotions are indicators of mental health concerns. But, she says, time is of the essence.
Early detection, early treatment is a critical issue for dealing with mental health issues.
Stories like Michael Hill's, where disaster is narrowly averted, gives people like Antoinette Tuff hope that more attention can be brought to mental health treatment, starting with kids and their parents.
We as adults have to sit back and listen. Can't say anything. Get your paper and your pen out and listen to what our children are saying.
For GPB News, I'm Destiny Robinson in Atlanta.
That report featured Antoinette Tuff, who talked Michael Brandon Hill down. She has become a vocal gun control advocate. There have been calls to arm teachers. It's an idea that President Trump supports.
It only works where you have people very adept at using firearms, of which you have many. And it would be teachers and coaches. If the coach had a firearm in his locker when he ran at this guy, that coach was very brave. Saved a lot of lives, I suspect. But if he had a firearm, he wouldn't have had a run. He would have shot, and that would have been the end of it.
But Antoinette Tuff told me arming teachers is the wrong approach.
If I had had a gun, we'd have all been dead. Because I had tried to commit suicide 2 days before that. I was mentally not stable. And when you get two unmentally stable people in the room with weapons of that magnitude, then nothing can come out of it but danger. Come out from my safe zone in my classroom with my 20 or 30 kids, and you want me to now take my life in jeopardy and be at the front line. Mentally, I'm already in anxiety, overwhelmed, and all I'm thinking about is my children and my baby and my husband at home. And if I die this instant, who's going to help them out? So, you know, you got to think about all that when we're looking at this.
Arming teachers is just one area of the gun debate that creates major divisions. But one point where most people agree is not arming people who are mentally ill. DeKalb County Public Defender Annie Dietz specializes in mental health. She represented Michael Brandon Hill, the school shooter at the Ronald E. McNair Discovery Learning Academy. She joins us now in studio. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning.
So what were your first impressions of Michael Brandon Hill when you first met him?
It was clear upon meeting Mr. Hill that he had some serious limitations cognitively and with mental illness. And as we delved into his social history, working with the social worker who was working on his case, Tanya Brown, the records that we were able to uncover, the history that we were able to create, verified that our first impression was accurate. He had had a number of suicide attempts, a number of hospitalizations, and a very limited IQ. In his life, a school was the only place that he ever really felt safe or protected, that adults cared about children. He knew that the police would come quickly, and would come with force, and that the event would end quickly was his hope.
Now, I know you've said that he reached out for help, but our system as it exists is not really equipped to give people like Mr. Hill help. Talk about a little bit what you meant about that.
Well, I represent specifically a population of people, mentally ill folks who are in the throes of the criminal justice system. And Mr. Hill was typical of so many of those people who, I mean, if you think about it, our society really stigmatizes mental illness and is reluctant to talk about it, much less deal with it and treat it. It's hard for people with means to manage their mental illness. It's hard for them to get medication. It's hard for them to take medication consistently and get treatment and go to therapy and do all of those things. Mr. Hill was born without any means, without a real system of support, of family support. And he was born with cognitive limitations. His IQ found him somewhere in the mild mental retardation category. And then he also was diagnosed bipolar with psychotic features. So for him, he was like so many of my clients who don't even have a home, much less the ability to get and take and maintain medication. So he, from the outset of his life, he was at a distinct disadvantage from say, you or I. And the system, he reached out for help. Our system does a decent job of protecting juveniles. There were resources available for juveniles. But when he aged out of that system, he found himself homeless, without supports, and just kind of cast aside by society.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing with a lot of these attempted mass school shootings or mass school shootings like the one in Parkland is that oftentimes the people who are doing it have mental health issues. And I know that President Trump has talked about the need for mental health care. You actually specifically work with people that need mental health treatment when you go in as a public defender. Talk a little bit more about what your day is like when you're dealing with people.
Well, DeKalb County, the Public Defender's Office in DeKalb County is unique in the fact that we have a specialized mental health division. So we are really more fortunate than a lot of public defender's offices in the country in that our office really focuses on trying to develop kind of more holistic representation of these folks who have mental illness. So we have two attorneys who are dedicated to representing folks with mental health issues of legal significance, people who aren't competent to stand trial, people who might be not guilty by reason of insanity, or people with serious mitigation. We also have three social workers who work with us who are actually so vital to that effort. And what we get cases where people, attorneys go in and they recognize that there may be a mental health issue in their client and they refer those cases to us. And we go in and start working on why the person is in jail. You find a lot of people, I know that what's publicized are the mentally ill people who are involved in these mass shootings and things like that. But my experience is more with people who are arrested due to what I would call status crimes by virtue of their homelessness or by virtue of their mental illness. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is people who are homeless, so they're charged with, let's say, criminal trespass for being in a store and being a nuisance to the patrons of that store, or people who are charged with disorderly conduct for acting out on a MARTA train or something like that. That's really what I encounter more commonly, not people who are a danger to society, but people who are more of a nuisance to society. And what we try to do is figure out why they're there, what their issues are. And then I'm involved actually with a project called the NIC Project in DeKalb County, which involves multiple agencies. It involves Atlanta Legal Aid, Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities, a lot of the community service providers. So we actually once a month meet, talk about these cases, talk about what resources are available, and try to put in housing, try to put in treatment for these folks, try to make sure that they have a consistent line of receiving and taking their medication.
So what happens next to those who are incarcerated? Do they receive the help that they need, the mental health treatment that they need?
Well, jails and prisons are not therapeutic environments. I mean, they're just not designed for that. That's not their purpose, and that's not really what they're funded to do. So there's no, I think that there's a public misconception that people who are housed in jails, and I can speak more to jails than prisons because that's a population that I see day in and day out, those folks are not receiving mental health treatment as we would think of mental health treatment. They're not receiving counseling. They're not receiving group therapy. They're not receiving kind of the adaptive living skills, learning how to function outside of the jail, most of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are limited programs in the jails for substance abuse treatment, and there are GED classes and things like that. But the folks that I represent aren't eligible for those programs due to the lack of stability. So, you know, are people given medication in jails? Yes, when the jail doctors deem it necessary and appropriate, which might be less than I would have deemed it necessary and appropriate. But yes, is medication given, but not treatment. So I think that the idea that people who are in jail are receiving mental health treatment is not accurate.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of us think that once they are in the system, that they're at least getting the care that they need, but that is not necessarily the case.
Not always the case.
Yeah, so they can wind up coming back out and rejoining the population with the same issues they kind of went in.
Right, and likely recidivizing, you know. So I teach a class at Emory Law that's mental health issues in the criminal justice system, and it's about 30 law students. And on the second class of the semester, I take the class into the jail. And specifically, I take them into the mental health. So mental health patients in the jail, mental health inmates, are kind of segregated from the rest of the population. And I took, you know, every year it never fails when I take the class in to see the people who are in those pods. The class is 100% shocked that people who are experiencing this degree of mental health issues are in a jail and not in a hospital. And I think that it would shock most of the public to see the kind of people who spend months in jail just by virtue of the fact that they are mentally ill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Michael Brandon Hill, who you represented, he actually is in prison. Is that where he should be?
I don't think so. The problem is that judges have very little discretion in where somebody is sent. Unless somebody is not competent to stand trial and not likely to ever become competent to stand trial, or unless somebody is not guilty by reason of insanity, which is a very small percentage of the population, the way that statute exists, it's almost, to find somebody not guilty by reason of insanity is like threading a needle. There's very few people who would actually be not guilty by reason of insanity. Those are the only two categories of criminal defendants who end up in, say, Georgia Regional Hospital or in the custody of the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities. And we work very closely with those hospitals. And they do a very good job of treating those people that they have there. But for people who end up being found competent to stand trial and who don't have a not guilty by reason of insanity defense, the judge really has no choice but to send them to prison. There's not an alternative to that other than release. And really where we're lacking the most is in the community treatment, right? So we deinstitutionalized this population of people. We closed hospitals, which I think is the right answer. I mean, I think we want mentally ill people being treated in the least restrictive means possible in the community. But without the funding to support these community mental health centers, people are not set up to succeed. They don't have the supports necessary. So without more of that, this is the biggest crisis facing the criminal justice system. We don't have housing. We don't have adequate support systems. I mean, there's been a great deal of criminal justice reform under the governor, and he's done a great job of that. I think that this is really the next wave, is putting these support systems in place. Because if you look at the numbers, it costs a lot less to treat somebody who's mentally ill in the community than to house them in jail or prison, if you look at the per diem cost of that.
Annie Dietz is a public defender in DeKalb County. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Leah Fleming. The flu season is winding down, but we need to keep our guard up. 100 years ago, the Spanish flu struck. It ultimately killed roughly 100 million people worldwide. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from the author of a new book on the origins of the Spanish flu and whether it could happen again. We'd love to hear from you. How seriously do you take the flu? Do you get a flu shot? Well, you can call us at 404-500-9457. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Chris Thiele is a master mandolinist. That's Chris Thiele performing My Oh My with the progressive bluegrass band Punch Brothers. Chris is a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient and has multiple Grammy Awards. His first win came when he was just 16 years old. Many public radio listeners know him best as host of Live From Here, which comes to Atlanta's Fox Theater on Saturday night. Live From Here used to be called A Prairie Home Companion, formerly hosted by Garrison Keillor. My colleague Adam Ragusea talked to Thiele about his music and his first year and a half in public radio.
Let's do a little public radio business geekery, because I think our audience is nerds and they like to hear about such things. Man, you were in such a tough spot walking into this show that you do. I reckon, at least you're 37, I think. So you're a millennial, barely on the older end of the spectrum. But like me, you're an old millennial. And man, Prairie Home Companion, at least under the leadership of Garrison Keillor, was, I've seen the numbers, a show that skewed real old on public radio stations. And you have been handed this monumental task of trying to bring new, younger audiences to public radio on what had historically been one of the oldest public radio shows in terms of who was listening to it. And a lot of people in the business have been looking to you to save us in many respects. So no pressure. How's it been going in your mind?
Well, I've been having a lot of fun. You know, I love putting on shows. That's my job. I put on a show, you know, every Saturday, or, well, I guess it works out to every other Saturday. But so that part of it isn't daunting. I mean, that's just sort of a continuation of my whole life. I try and put on shows and I really don't think about the demographics of the show. A buddy of mine once gave me a pep talk a long time ago, kind of a coming of age pep talk, like a musical coming of age pep talk, saying, which was centered around a truism, which is that you have to be true to your audience of one, and that is that takes the edge off. I know that I have to like it if I'm going to be a part of it, and so once I like it. Then I absolutely start thinking about all the people that I hope can get a kick out of it. But it's really the same. It's the same process for me doing this as it is for a Punch Brothers show or for a solo show. I think it's harder. It's hardest for me to make it over that first hurdle, which is I have to like it. You know how they say you're your own worst critic.
Sure.
I feel I'm pretty hard on myself. So once I get it into a spot where I like it, you know, I can kind of take the handkerchief out and wipe my brow off and then get to the more enjoyable part of the job, which is figuring out how to present this thing that I now feel is pretty good.
Yeah.
I firmly believe that if you make something good, it starts to transcend genre, and it transcends generation.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? I would go ahead and say that, like, genres and things like that, can make generational appeals. Like certain textual aesthetics can be so specific that they make their appeals to a very specific kind of person. And I've just been so disinterested in that kind of music making from a very young age that to me the idea of I think that the idea of aiming something that you do at a specific demographic or generation is equally counterproductive. I mean, that's not what making good stuff is about. You want to make things that are so good that they can make an appeal to anyone wherever they happen to be. And I'm not saying that's what we're doing, but that is certainly the goal. So I don't come in here going like, oh, this show is going to be for young people now. Because I don't want to make that show. I don't want to make something that only young people like. That means it's not good enough if only young people like it. And if only old people like it, same thing. Then it's not you have to try and make something that transcends both genre and generation.
We're talking to Chris Thiele. He is the host of Public Radio's Live From Here, which comes to Atlanta's Fox Theater on Saturday. Chris, the show was formerly called A Prairie Home Companion. It changed that name when its former host, Garrison Keillor, or after its host, former host, Garrison Keillor, was accused of sexual misconduct. That, of course, has nothing to do with you. But I'm curious about the name, Live From Here. Where did that come from? What does it mean to you?
I like you might be detecting a theme for me, which is I love blank canvases. And Live From Here, boy, that is a blank canvas, right? It just basically sort of means like we're live and we're live from a place.
Right.
I like also that it's
Atlanta's
here.
Fox
it's not
theater in this particular
such
instance.
As exactly. So that it's a show title that really works for what we're doing, which is hopefully anything. That's what gives me the biggest thrill is approaching, you know, sitting down in my little studio on Monday with a blank canvas and some great musical and spoken word guests and start sort of the air traffic control process for that particular show. What can I do to help all of this work together and sort of provide some glue. You've got for this show Father John Misty on one side and Nico Case on the other. These are two artists that I love and respect so much. The a week spent trying to figure out how to make it all, you know, to bring it in for a smooth landing is that just sounds like a great way to spend a week to me.
That's great. However, I don't associate either of those artists with bluegrass. You are a bluegrass player. Let's, in fact, listen to a little bit of you playing. Here's a clip of you playing Sleep With One Eye Open with Michael Daves, who's from Georgia. So, Chris, what's it like adapting your own style with that of everyone that you have on the show?
I would hasten to point out that yes, I grew up with bluegrass music, but that's hardly been the focus of my life. I mean, since I was maybe, I don't know, 15 or 16, I play the mandolin, which is commonly associated with bluegrass. And certainly my band Punch Brothers has, we look like a bluegrass band. What we sound like though is kind of all over the deck. So, I'm not really doing any contortions or anything to sort of ramble around, the various textural aesthetics that music presents, which are just that in my opinion. It's the cover of the book. It has nothing to do with what's in the book. It's an instrument can play whatever the instrumentalist behind it can imagine, and so certainly we associate certain instruments with certain textural aesthetics, but they do not dictate what you're up to as a musician.
Let's get to some more music, just to give people a taste of what you bring to the stage and what you will be bringing to the stage on Saturday at the Fox Theater. You're going to go on tour with the Punch Brothers this summer, and you've got a new album coming out. Here's a clip from a new song that you guys performed on the show, Live From Here. It's called Locked In.
See the barman winking at us as he pours last call. Meaning friends, I think I might forget to check the hallway while I'm kicking everybody out. Get your axes out, rage against the rising of the light. Forever. Or till the morning sneaks up on this good long night.
Chris, what's it been like maintaining your old musical career while at the same time doing a weekly public radio show? It's got to be a tough gig.
There's a lot going on right now, but that hardly makes me special, right? I mean, that's the malaise of our time. We're cramming every last thing we possibly could cram into every second of our waking hours, and so I'm no exception to that. This is a fun bit of consistent activity for me, being in a band like Punch Brothers or Nickel Creek or, you know, Goat Rodeo Sessions or whatever it is. Those things can. They wax and wane in terms of the intensity of the work, whereas this is pretty consistent intensity, which I'm actually sort of enjoying at this point in my life. Back to the air traffic control, there can be near collisions.
Indeed.
In the air, and still working all of that off or working it all out, because there's a lot of it's still a new gig. I've only been doing it for a year and a half, 2 years.
Sure, and you've brought a set of new and very different talents and insights to the show. You've also been having to do new things like sketch comedy. here's a clip of one sketch that you did about defining the relationship.
I have this work thing coming up, and
oh?
Yeah, it's basically like a party. Hmm. Do you want to come? I mean, no pressure.
Oh, sure. No, it sounds fun.
Okay, good, because Candace, my coworker, said I should invite the guy I'm seeing and live with and am married to and fathered my children, and I was like, what if he says no?
Wait. You told your coworker Candace about me?
Oh, well, she saw our family Christmas card with the picture from Vale and was like, ooh, who's that guy?
Oh, so awkward, huh?
No, totally. I was like, my husband?
Labels are so weird.
You know, this feels really great to mm-hmm. talk about. You know, I almost brought it up when we were buying the house, but I chickened out.
Yeah. I almost brought it up when I proposed.
No way.
Imagine? Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So funny.
I can't believe I have to leave on a business trip to Dubuque. You know, right as things are heating up between us.
Yeah. You know, I'll miss you so much. You better call me both nights.
Mm. You know, maybe you could drive me to the airport so we could spend some extra time together.
Oh, I'm busy then.
I didn't say when it was.
Well, let's not rush things, okay? Call a car.
Eli's Jitney Car Service. Some things are worth taking a little more time, but getting to the airport's not one of them.
So, Chris, what's it like doing something new, being an onstage comic, being an actor?
Yes, that's I mean, it's been amazing for me just to get to do that. It's almost like as if I were all of a sudden, you know, being made to play like a few tennis points or something in the middle of the show. It's not necessarily my thing. I love doing it. And you know, maybe it can lend a certain, casual air to a bit of sketch comedy that it wouldn't otherwise have. I have no delusions as to my relative merits or lack thereof in the acting department.
That was Chris Thiele, host of Live From Here. He spoke with my colleague, Adam Ragusea. Thiele shares the stage with Father John Misty and Nico Case in a live performance of Live From Here at the Fox Theater on Saturday night. You can hear it live on GPB's statewide network. In Atlanta, you can stream it at gpbnews.org by choosing the GPB radio stream. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Don Smith edits the show. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Leah Fleming. Chris Thiele takes us out with the Punch Brothers performing Julep.
I died happy in my sleep. I died happy in my sleep. Our children around and you looking down from heaven's a julep on the porch. Heaven's a julep on the porch. You and me rocking the grandfather clock is tick, tick. She brought